So let me extend my welcome to everyone today to our audio conference workshop entitled Using Spiritually Modified Cognitive Behavioral Therapy in Practice, an Evidence-Based Perspective, led by Dr. David Hodge, Assistant Professor in the Department of Social Work at Arizona State University and a Senior Non-Resident Fellow at a Program for Research on Religion and Urban Civil Society at the University of Pennsylvania. David's audio conference... Welcome, Carol. Glad you made it on. We're just doing introduction.
Thank you. Okay.
David's audio conference will review that although social workers are interested in using spiritual interventions in practice settings, little content has appeared in the literature to guide practitioners in the use of such interventions. Using an evidence-based perspective, the presentation will focus on one particular therapeutic modality, spiritually modified cognitive behavioral therapy. Modifying traditional CBT self-statements with beliefs and values drawn from clients' spiritual narratives may result in enhanced outcomes for some spiritually motivated clients. Potential enhancements include faster recovery, improved treatment compliance, lower post-treatment relapse, and reduced treatment disparity. The presentation will conclude by illustrating, with the help of audio conference participants, the construction of spiritually modified CBT self-statements that reflect common Islamic and Christian values. Just before we begin our session, let me go over a couple of important housekeeping items. First of all, and many of you can probably hear some of the background noise that occurs when you have this many callers, we'll be using a muting function to eliminate that background noise that might compete with David's presentation. However, although for when David's speaking, you won't be able to ask questions, at several intervals, we'll be able to disable the muting function and enter a live mode so that you can make comments or raise questions for discussion. Just be aware that during these live portions of the conference, any background noise in your office or home will be heard by all of the 35 or other 40 participants, so just to give you fair warning. Secondly, a reminder that today's call will be recorded for folks who can't participate in the call but are interested in the material, and it's our obligation to make sure you know that this will be a recorded session. Thirdly, if at all possible, we encourage you to follow the PowerPoint presentation that David put together and that we provided access to when you registered for the audio conference. If for some reason you haven't been able to access the outline or aren't able to access it currently, just send me an email right away to rick@nacsw.org, and I'll shoot you an email with a link, or I'll send you an email attachment with that PowerPoint so you have it at your disposal. Lastly, when we do questions and answers, because we're a fairly large group, please do your best to keep your questions and comments crisp and to the point, and we can keep the session moving at a good pace for all of us. So without any further ado, I'm just delighted to present, actually for our third time, David's our first three-time audio conference presenter, Dr. David Hodge. David, I'll probably start at the beginning by muting folks because there does seem to be a fair amount of background noise.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here, and I hope that you all will be able to get something out of this presentation that you find useful in your practice of social work. So I'll move on to our first slide, presentation overview, and that just gives sort of a summary of what we're going to be talking about today. So first of all, we'll talk about the use of spiritual interventions in practice, more specifically, just how widely used spiritual interventions are social work practice settings. I think the evidence in this area is pretty interesting. Then we'll talk a little bit about evidence-based practice and what are two specific frameworks that are commonly used within evidence-based practice to assess the effectiveness of various types of interventions, including spiritual interventions. Then we'll talk about the research on spiritually modified cognitive behavioral therapy from an evidence-based perspective, and we'll overview four outcomes that may be enhanced through the use of spiritually modified CBT. And then we'll go over, from a theoretical perspective, the process of modifying secular CBT self-statements that conform to client's spiritual belief systems. Then we'll actually practice constructing some spiritually modified CBT self-statements. So moving on to the next slide, I thought that we would just, before we get into the heart of the presentation, that we'd just spend a little bit of time defining spirituality, religion, and the relationship between these two constructs, since that's sort of what we're talking about. But in terms of defining, moving on to the next slide, in terms of defining spirituality and religion, there's no real agreement among scholars or practitioners. There's a lot of debate in the literature, and there has been no consensus that's emerged regarding how these two particular terms should be understood. Moving on to the next slide, this is a study that I did with a nationally representative sample of graduate students, of MSW students that are affiliated with NASW. So these are their definitions of spirituality. So I asked them, how would you define spirituality? And these are the various categories that emerged after analysis. So roughly a third defined spirituality in personally constructed terms with no mention of the transcendent, no mention of a God, no mention of a higher power, or anything beyond the individual. Now moving on to the next slide, there are definitions of religion. Now what's interesting about these various definitions of religion is that while definitions of spirituality tended to fall into individual distinct categories, when people define religion, they use more than one term or more than one concept to define religion. And so as a result, these percentages add up to more than 100. And you can see that there's some overlap between the two definitions. Moving on to the next slide, that's the relationship between spirituality and religion. And you can see that roughly half of the sample said that some kind of relationship exists between spirituality and religion, which I think is a good response. You can see that a little bit further down, 6% said no relationship exists between spirituality and religion. And I'm always a little bit concerned about that because for many clients, spirituality and religion are related. So moving on to the next slide, this is a study conducted by the Gallup Organization, and they took a random sample of the U.S. population. Even though it's only small, the N is 100, this gives us, I think, a fairly accurate snapshot of how the general U.S. population defines spirituality, and roughly 70% define spirituality as some type of relationship with a transcendent entity, either something beyond the individual or a god or a higher power. Then approximately 30% made no mention of the transcendent. So the next slide is my own personal definition of spirituality. So I define spirituality as individual's existential relationship with God or however they perceive transcendent reality. So that would be pretty similar to most of the U.S. population, at least. It would be consistent with or congruent with how most people would define spirituality. Now, the next slide is my definition of religion. So I understand religion as flowing from spirituality, expressing the spiritual relationship in particular forms, beliefs, and practices that are developed in community. That's very important, in community with others that share similar experiences of transcendent reality. So spirituality tends to be more individualistic, somewhat malleable, it can change over time, whereas religion tends to be more of an expression of spirituality and tends to have more of a community focus. So moving on to the next slide, there's these two egg-shaped ovals. And what this is supposed to depict is that spirituality and religion are overlapping concepts or constructs. And so, for most people, they would be in the center, in the overlapping area. So most people in the U.S. would tend to define as both spiritual and religious. But there would be some people that would self-identify as being spiritual, but not religious. And so those individuals would tend to fall into what some people call the New Age movement or syncretic spirituality. So their spirituality would be completely divorced of any type of community entity. They would practice their spirituality strictly by themselves, apart from a small group or any kind of community forum. And on the other side, you would have people that would be religious but not spiritual. So these might include people that would, let's say, attend a church or a synagogue or a temple or a mosque just because their spouse attends, or they think it might be good for their children to be exposed to moral values or something along those lines, but they wouldn't have that personal connection with God. So that's one way of looking at spirituality and religion that I think is helpful. So are there any questions about that before we move on?
Okay, David, I've opened up the lines.
Okay. Any questions about that or just some basic definitions? Okay, well, I guess we're all on the same page, so we can move on to the next section. So that's the use of spiritual interventions in practice settings. So moving on to our next slide, which is definitions. So this is a common definition of an intervention, a process designed to change an individual's cognition, behavior, or emotional state. So building upon that, a spiritual intervention can be understood as a therapeutic strategy that incorporates the spiritual or religious dimensions as a central component of the intervention. Moving on to our next slide. This is I won't spend too much time on this, but this is kind of a theoretical model of how spirituality may engender or cause various positive outcomes. So on one side you have spirituality and spiritual tradition or religion. Then on the other side you have these various positive health and mental health outcomes, such as reduced alcohol, tobacco, and other drug usage, or decreased morbidity, and that should be decreased mortality, not morality, and increased resiliency and coping, increased pro-social attitudes and behaviors, increased mental health. Then in the middle, you have these various pathways. So these are pathways through which spirituality and religion may cause these various salutary outcomes. So through, for instance, health promotive behaviors or lifestyles. So if you remember a faith tradition, for example, that suggests that it's not a good idea to smoke or use alcohol, then that's going to lead to reduced alcohol, tobacco, and other drug usage. So our interventions are sort of targeted towards those various pathways. So we seek to alter something in those central pathways. So that's just a way of thinking about this conceptually. So moving on to our next slide. So this is a national sample of direct practitioners that are affiliated with NASW. This research was conducted by Canda and Furman in 1999, about 10 years or so ago now. So what they found is pretty high levels of spiritual practices. So 87% reported using non-sectarian spiritual language or concepts in their practice of social work. And a further 81% reported recommending participation in a religious or spiritual support system. 68% reported using religious language or concepts. So it's a little bit lower. So the top one, 87%, was the use of spiritual language or concepts. So people seem to be more comfortable using spiritual language or concepts than religious language or concepts. And 63% reported helping clients develop religious or spiritual rituals as a clinical intervention. Now these frequencies really surprised a lot of people, and because this would suggest that most social workers are using some kind of spiritual intervention in their practices. And it's been critiqued by people that have pointed out, well, the response rate is only 26%. And so that's something to bear in mind. So it may be the case that people that are really invested in spirituality and religion disproportionately responded to Canda and Furman's survey. So moving on to the next slide, which is a national sample of gerontological social workers that came from NASW and GSA. So this is a different sample, gerontological social workers. And what's nice about Murdoch's particular study that was conducted in 2004 is that she provided sort of a more nuanced understanding of how people responded by actually breaking out the response categories into often, sometimes, or never. And the questions were similar, but there was also some differences too. So for instance, she combined using religious or spiritual language instead of breaking them out as Canda and Furman did. So we see again that 82% either often or sometimes use spiritual or religious language, so well over three-quarters of the sample. And again, well over three-quarters of the sample recommended a support group. And then, again, over two-thirds report that they help clients reflect upon death. And over half reported that they help clients develop rituals, at least sometimes or often. Now, the response rate for this study was a little bit higher, but it's still pretty marginal in the sense that only a third of the people responded. So moving on to our next slide, which is licensed clinical social workers in the Mid-Atlantic state. This was conducted a little bit more recently. So again, we see pretty high rates of use of spiritual interventions in practice settings, with 82% reporting either using spiritual or religious language or concepts, 81% have recommended participating in a religious or spiritual program, 67% report helping clients develop religious or spiritual rituals, and then 75% report helping clients consider the spiritual meaning of their current life situation, and then almost everybody, 98%, report helping clients reflect upon belief about loss or other difficult life situation. And again, almost 100%, 93% more specifically, report helping clients consider the ways that their religious or spiritual beliefs are helpful in their practice of social work. And the response rate is 43%, so we're getting close to the 50% that a number of authorities suggest is necessary in order to be able to generalize the response to the whole sample. So this Mid-Atlantic state is probably, knowing the author, it's probably Virginia, and Virginia is not known as being one of a Bible Belt state, and so it's just interesting that these high levels of use of spiritual interventions are being reported. Okay, our next slide is a sample of social workers affiliated with a regional Southeastern chapter of NASW. And so again, we see that there's pretty high usage, so a little bit, actually it's a little bit lower in the sample. So 70% report using religious or spiritual language or concepts, and 55% report recommending participation in a program, and 25%, which is lower than some of the previous studies we've seen, report helping clients develop a ritual as a practice intervention. Now the response rate for this was 84%, so we can be pretty confident that these percentages, these frequencies, actually do represent what's going on in the field. So moving on to the next study, which is a sample of direct practitioners affiliated with a New York chapter of an ASW, excluding those people residing in New York City. So the authors told me that there was an extra charge associated with getting social workers that were living in New York City to participate in this, and so they couldn't afford it. So it's people in New York, further north in New York City. And they had a good response rate, close to 60%, so again, we can be fairly confident about these responses. And 77% report using spiritual language or concepts, and 57% report recommending participation in a spiritual program. Okay, I think this is our last study. Our next slide is our last study, and this is a national sample of board-certified clinical social workers who report working with youth, children, and adolescents. 42% response rate, so it's below 50, but fairly close to 50, the cutoff rate. And so again, we see fairly high percentages. So for instance, 92% report that they help children or youth reflect upon beliefs about loss or other difficult life situations. 60% report, down at the bottom of the slide, report helping youth or children reflect upon what happens after death, and 56% report teaching or recommending meditation. So moving on to our next slide to summarize. So many practitioners appear to use spiritual interventions, and based upon the existing evidence, I think we can say that most practitioners are actually using spiritual interventions at least sometimes in their practice of social work, and that seems to hold true across various types of clinical social workers, whether they're working with children and youth or the elderly or just general social work practice. Now what's interesting is that even though there's this really wide use of spiritual interventions in the field, very few guidelines have emerged regarding the use of spiritual interventions. There's been a number of people that have pointed out that there's been very little that has been developed to sort of guide practitioners or to help practitioners work with clients' spirituality in an ethical and professional way. And as part of part of the evidence for that argument. There's been many of these same surveys that we've gone over have asked various social work samples if they've received training on spirituality and religion during their graduate education. And in pretty much every case, the majority of people report they received little or no training on spirituality or religion during their graduate education. So moving on to the next slide, which is questions. Any questions?
Yeah, can I just throw in here, David? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
There has been some scuttlebutt, at least around here, I'm in the Metro Detroit area, that there have been legal issues raised about folks using spiritual interventions who are not theologians or ordained ministers. Would I be right to be encouraged that that may not be such a big issue? I'm feeling that it's more normative than one might think to use spiritual interventions, and that we may not be on legal fringes then.
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the things that I encourage people to do in my class is to develop a separate informed consent form that includes reference to the fact that you may use spiritual or religious interventions if it is appropriate. And that way it's kind of upfront, and it provides some legal backing. Because I think that we do want to be wise, and there have been cases, both here in the U.S. and other countries, where people have gotten into trouble for using spiritual intervention. So not everyone understands, in my opinion, the doctrine of separation of church and state appropriately.
Mm.
And so there can be situations where you can potentially run into trouble, and having a separate informed consent helps mitigate those problems, potential problems.
Do you have one available that we could use, or do people just develop their own? Or?
I don't have one. The one that I use in my class comes from a text by Jerry Miller. Now, if you want, Rick perhaps can make a note to remind me, and I can get that reference, and I can send it to Rick, and Rick can post it with the other references for this presentation.
That would be helpful. Thank you so much.
Sounds like a good plan, David. I'll make sure to contact you to follow up on that.
Okay, thanks.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. On page 3, you were talking about the national sample of practitioners. And when you were going from 87% used non-sectarian spiritual language, do those lower percentages, along with the other items, do the people who use 87% non-sectarian language also answer that they're using religious concepts and language that are more specific? In other words, does one assume the other, or are these just separate and discrete from one another?
Well, it really sort of depends, because different researchers have some researchers break them out, and they separate spirituality from religion. So Ed Kanda and Lee Furman did that, and they asked a separate question about each. Whereas I think most of the other researchers have included them as sort of a synonymous type term. So in other words, they just ask people, have you used the spiritual or religious concepts? So it's
about 45% out of you had a 26% return rate out of 2,069 people surveyed. Is that correct?
Is that the first study? Is that the Kanda and Furman one?
Yeah, Kanda.
Okay.
Okay, yes.
All right, and so each response is 80% of the 26%. So 87% of those who did respond.
Yes.
Okay, I see.
So the total number of respondents in that study was 2,069, but they sent out roughly 8,000 surveys total.
Uh-huh.
And they got 2,000 back, or roughly a quarter back.
Oh, I see.
Then of the 2,000 that they got back, 87% reported using non-sectarian spiritual language or concepts.
Oh, I thought you meant that N equaled the universe of people sampled, and then you took, okay, never. Those are the respondents.
Yes, yes.
Oh, that's a big difference.
It is. That's why I'm glad you asked that question.
Yeah, something didn't seem right to me. The other thing is, when you were just talking about a separate informed consent.
Yes.
I don't. you're talking about a PHI level consent, or are you talking about consent to treat including areas of? So they're two different consents. A consent to treatment would that included the topic of spirituality and religion would be the kind of consent you need, I would think, not a consent to obtain or release information.
That sounds reasonable.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Another thing, this is a little bit off the topic, but it's this relates to some of my other work. The Joint Commission, the organization that was formerly known as JCO, they require a brief spiritual assessment in many settings, including hospitals, long-term care facilities providing addiction services, and a number of other settings as well. And so they recommend this sort of brief assessment. So there's a lot of consensus emerging, I think, around the idea that it's okay to do a brief spiritual assessment to find out if spirituality or religion is relevant to the problems that the client faces. And then if it is relevant, then you can move into a more in-depth assessment and then perhaps develop spiritual interventions. So I'm not really sort of talking about that part of the process in this particular presentation, but I just want to throw it out there so you're aware that there has been some work done on this particular issue.
Can I just make a comment?
Yes, please.
As a past school social worker, I find it really interesting because I believe the schools do, they are so nervous about litigation, and any social worker discussing spiritual nature type things with a child, that they discourage it with pretty strong vehemence, and I suspect that's why Kraftfort and Sheridan came up with such lower percentages of the people who work with youth, because I think it's a reflection of our litigious society.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are different issues in play when you're talking about children, and so I think that social workers, in particular school social workers, have to be more careful when they're interacting with children and to take steps to incorporate the parents and to make sure that the parents are on board in those kind of situations.
Right.
There's a lot of people that are concerned that social workers are not being respectful of clients, their children's in this case, religious and spiritual beliefs, and maybe attempting to sort of undermine those people working within the parameters of the family's belief system. Okay, if there's nothing else, we'll move on. Okay, great. Well, the next section is evidence-based practice frameworks for assessing the effectiveness of spiritual and other interventions. So moving on to our next slide. So as is the case with definitions of spirituality and religion, evidence-based practice is a controversial topic. There's many people that think that we shouldn't even be moving in this direction. They would argue that this concept of evidence-based practice comes from the field of medicine and that it may be fine for medicine, but it's not really appropriate for what we do as social workers. So in addition, there's no agreement about what evidence-based practice is. There's lots of discussion about various frameworks or understandings or models of evidence-based practice. We'll talk about two of them in a second. So there's no agreement about what evidence-based practice is, in addition to it being controversial. Now, with that being said, there is growing support for the concept of evidence-based practice. It's a pretty large movement in social work and other fields. And furthermore, the evidence-based practice movement is international. It's happening not just in the U.S. and Canada. It's happening over in Britain and Australia and other European countries. So it seems like this is going to be the framework that is going to be increasingly salient in social work practice settings. So moving on to our next slide. So I'd like to briefly overview two evidence-based practice frameworks. One is the APA Division 12 framework, and that's been around for a little bit longer. And the second one, more recent, is the APA Presidential Task Force on Evidence-Based Practice that was put together in the last few years. Okay, moving on to our next slide. The APA Division 12 Task Force came up with three sort of categories for interventions. So a well-established intervention, that would be an empirically valid intervention that practitioners would feel comfortable using in a given setting. And then below that would be a probably efficacious intervention, which is likely effective, but really more research needs to be done. Then the third category is experimental. And so in theory, practitioners should not be using experimental interventions, or really even probably efficacious interventions, according to this particular framework or understanding of evidence-based practice. Moving on to our next slide. So what does a well-established intervention look like? So there's various criteria that Division 12 has come up with. They're pretty specific. So treatment manuals have to be used, for one thing. So the rationale for that is that if something is written down in a sort of a cookbook format, someone can pick up that cookbook and they can follow the recipe and they can implement the intervention in a specific way that has been proven to be helpful. There has to be a clear description of the sample characteristics, and the reason for that is that an intervention that may be effective on one particular group of clients, let's say middle-class European Americans, may not be effective with, let's say, lower-class African Americans because of cultural differences. So the sample characteristics have to be clearly described. Now, evidence has to be demonstrated in one of two ways, and in practice, really only the first way seems to be accepted. At least two good studies, and a good study is typically defined or operationalized as a random control trial conducted by at least two different investigators, the safeguard against bias, demonstrating equivalence to a well-established treatment using adequate samples, which is understood to be at least 30 samples per group, or superiority to a placebo or another type of treatment. So in order to be well-established, an intervention has to meet all those specific criteria. So moving on to the next slide, this is what the APA's Presidential Task Force came up when they were given the task of defining evidence-based practice. So it's a little bit different understanding than the previous understanding of evidence-based practice. So the APA Presidential Task Force defined evidence-based practice as the integration of the best available research with clinical expertise in the context of patient characteristics, culture, and preferences. So now what I'd like to do in the next few slides is just break out those yellow highlighted concepts and talk about them a little bit as they intersect the issue of spirituality and religion. So moving on to the next slide, client preferences. Many clients, although not all, but many, want to integrate their spiritual beliefs and values into the therapeutic dialogue. There was an actual study conducted by the Gallup organization about a decade ago, and they found that 66% of the general public would prefer to see a professional counselor with spiritual beliefs and values, which I think would be good for the NACSW membership, and 81% wanted to have their own personal beliefs and values integrated into the counseling process. Now, there's also been a number of studies of actual client populations or client samples that's of the general public, and it could be that a different subset of the general public goes and sees practitioners. But in every case that I'm aware of, approximately six studies, a majority of clients have reported that they want to have their spiritual beliefs and values integrated into the counseling process. So moving on to the next slide, clinical expertise. So that's that part of the APA task force is consistent with the NASW Code of Ethics, which requires practitioners to provide services within the boundaries of their area of competence. And in our last question, people brought that up, that whole issue of competence and whether social workers should be providing religious and spiritual services and kind of what the boundaries are. So in terms of clinical expertise, that implies that if you're going to use spiritually modified CBT, that you would have some sort of background using cognitive behavioral therapy and some sort of knowledge of spiritually modified CBT. I think also that it's important to network with clergy, and our next slide just talks about collaborating with clergy. So clergy can be a really helpful resource when difficult issues arise or where spiritual expertise is needed. So an example of that might be that if you personally, in your child rearing practices, don't believe in spanking, but you're working with a client where, let's say you're doing family counseling, and this whole issue of spanking is pertinent to the issue that you're dealing with, and you're kind of unsure, okay, like where's the boundary between healthy discipline and abuse? So networking with clergy members from the client's tradition can be very helpful in those situations because they have a clear understanding of sort of where the boundaries lie on various issues. Now, it's important that clergy share similar worldviews with the client. So you want to try to get a clergy member, ideally from the client's tradition and from the client's even church or religious setting, ideally, if that's workable. Okay, moving on to the next slide, cultural competency. So another issue highlighted by the APA's Presidential Task Force is cultural competency. And there's various ways to understand cultural competency. This is a definition that I came up with that's derived from Sue and Sue, who are very prominent authors in the area of cultural competency. I've just tweaked it a little bit to make it a little bit more faith-friendly. So this understanding would say that cultural competency is composed of three dimensions. So one would be knowledge of your own worldview, our own worldview, beliefs, values, and biases, then developing an empathetic understanding of a culturally different, faith-based worldview, and that puts you in a position to be able to develop intervention strategies that are relevant and sensitive to the client's worldview. And really, I think that the heart of it is this second dimension, an empathetic understanding of a culturally different, faith-based worldview. If you can understand sort of the internal logic of your client's spiritual worldview, then that really is the key, I think, because once you understand that internal logic, then you're able to develop interventions that really sort of resonate with the client's worldview. It doesn't mean that we have to necessarily agree with all the various components within that particular worldview, but if we can understand why clients adhere to them and how they make sense from the client's perspective, then that really sets us up to develop really effective interventions. Okay, moving on to the next slide, I think it's helpful to picture spiritual competency as a continuum ranging from spiritually destructive on one hand to spiritually competent on the other. And we're all at different points along that continuum with different faith groups. So conversely, to put it differently, spiritual competency or cultural competency is not something you have or you don't have. It's more like a process, and we're all in the process of developing our spiritual competency with various faith groups and various cultural groups. Moving on to our next slide, evaluation of relevant research. One of the nice things about the APA Presidential Task Force, and in contrast to the Division 12 standards, is that the Presidential Task Force defines the best available research broadly to include things like meta-analyses, epidemiological studies, qualitative research. So that's a little bit more friendly, I think, or a little bit more nuanced understanding of evidence, although at the same time there tends to be a hierarchy of research methods, which is typically used to sort of attest to assess the research in a given area. So at the top of the hierarchy, the studies that are given most weight would be systematic reviews or meta-analyses, and then individual random control trials, and then quasi-experimental research, and then case-controlled and cross-sectional analysis, followed by case studies. So moving on to the next slide, our summary. So there's two common evidence-based frameworks that are sort of widely accepted. One is the APA Division 12. That's been around for a long time. People have criticized that. That framework has come under some sort of intellectual attack more recently for being overly reliant upon random control trials and being a little bit too formulaic. So the APA Presidential Task Force, I think that represents sort of the emerging, if there is an emerging consensus, that the APA Presidential Task Force represents what most people are sort of affirming in terms of an understanding of evidence-based practice. So even though this is coming from a field of psychology, social workers often take their cues from psychology, and the social work definitions of evidence-based practice tend to be pretty similar to the APA Presidential Task Force. And many people perceive that as being more holistic in the sense that it integrates concern for research with other factors such as clinical expertise, clients' preference or desires, and cultural considerations. So our next slide is any questions that people might have?
Let's see. I had a question. Were you talking about on your slide number 34, you're talking about that the, you were talking about spiritual competency.
Okay, yes.
Whether it's thought of in a categorical sense or not.
Yes.
Would you speak to that again, please?
So I think a lot of people tend to look at spiritual competency or cultural competency. I understand spiritual competency as a more defined version of cultural competency, so it's one aspect of cultural competency. But I think a lot of people think of spiritual competency as just something either you have or you don't have, kind of a, in other words, in a dichotomous sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's more healthy and it better captures the reality to think of it as more of a continuum, and that we're at sort of different points. So to go back to that kind of slide where on the one side destructive, on the other side competent. So an example of, let's say, spiritually destructive practice would be if you were working with a client, let's say that I was a feminist practitioner and I was firmly committed to egalitarian marriages. And I was working with a client, maybe they were like a Latter-day Saint or Southern Baptist or Muslim, and that particular family believed in complementary roles within marriage. So spiritually destructive would be that I would try to deliberately undermine or somehow get them to change and throw away their what they consider to be their appropriate and spiritually necessary model of marriage. So that would be an example of destructive. Then insensitive would be that, would be a little bit up from that, so that you would disagree with that. Maybe you're, to follow up on the same example, you're a feminist practitioner, and you're aware that, that many other people hold different understandings of marriage than you do, but you're just insensitive. And so when it comes up, you might just, rather than attempting to get them to change, you might make some disparaging comments or something along those lines. And then blind would be that you're just sort of clueless as to these differences. You haven't thought about them. You're unaware of them. And then sensitive, you might be aware of differences in marriage and other areas, and you try to be sensitive to them. And then competent, you would be fully aware of them. You understand the internal logic. You would even maybe have some types of intervention strategies that you could draw from that might sort of resonate with the client's worldview. So that, using the example of marital roles, that's one example of how to understand that continuum. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions about that whole evidence-based content?
David, just one quick housekeeping note. When we go into question and answer mode, obviously we can hear a lot of background noise. If you want to mute just your own phone, if you hit *6 on your phone, we won't hear anything in your background. It's always a challenge when we have this many folks in on the call. So if you're at a place where you can't really control the noise in your environment, if you hit *6, that will make sure that the rest of us don't wouldn't be hearing what's in your background as well.
Okay, well, if there's no other questions, I'll move on to the next section then. And that's entitled Research on Spiritually Modified CBT from an Evidence-Based Perspective. So moving on to our next slide. So in terms of background about CBT or cognitive therapy. CBT is a pretty widely used therapeutic modality, and people tend to look at individuals like Beck and Ellis as being the grandfather of this particular therapeutic modality. It's possible to summarize CBT as consisting of these two basic components that I've listed here. The first component would be the process of identifying unhealthy thought patterns that are underlying unproductive behaviors. Then once you have identified unproductive thought patterns, you replace them with healthy schema in the form of health-promoting self-statements. Now, there's been a substantial body of empirical evidence that has been conducted on cognitive behavioral therapy, and some of those citations, in particular the Chambliss and Holendijk 2001, that does a good job of summarizing the evidence on CBT. There's been so much evidence that's come out in favor of cognitive behavioral therapy that some people have sort of criticized this and suggested that maybe the evidence-based framework itself, with the premium that it places upon random controlled trials, may actually be biased in favor of cognitive behavioral therapy. So some practitioners that are more into psychodynamic models would have argued that. But regardless of that, the fact remains that CBT is widely affirmed as being effective. So moving on to the next slide, so spiritually modified CBT. So what is spiritually modified CBT? It's very similar to traditional cognitive therapy. The first step is exactly the same. You identify unproductive thoughts. But in the case of spiritually modified CBT, the unproductive thought patterns are replaced with positive self-statements drawn from client's spiritual worldview. In other words, you try to identify strengths in client's spiritual worldview, in their belief system, and then just incorporate those strengths into the therapy. So moving on to our next slide. So I conducted some research in order to see, from an evidence-based perspective, how effective spiritually modified cognitive behavioral therapy is. So I searched social work abstracts, Medline Psych Info, and dissertation abstracts. So the major databases that you would expect to find research on cognitive behavioral therapy. My keyword searches were spirituality and religion and cognitive therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. So I tried to cast a wide net as possible to get all available studies. I also reviewed reviews of spirituality and religion, and I even contacted some various experts in the field of spirituality and religion and asked them if they knew of any studies on this particular topic. Moving on to our next slide. So what was included? So in order to be included, a study had to integrate spiritual beliefs into traditional cognitive or cognitive behavioral therapy. The study had to feature clients wrestling with a specific type of psychological problem, so for example, depression or anxiety, something that social workers would be inclined to encounter in their practices. And the other criteria is it had to test effectiveness of the intervention using, let's say, pretest, post-test to document clinical effectiveness or the lack thereof. So another way of looking at it is that in order to be included, studies had to use an experimental or quasi-experimental design. Moving on to the next slide. So studies were excluded from my research if they addressed medically oriented problems. So for instance, let's say if people were recovering from like heart attacks or something like that, or if they dealt with meditation. So I considered meditation to be a separate issue. Studies were also excluded if they use spiritually oriented interventions that required really specialized trainings or applied only in particular faith-based agencies. So an example would be, I think I came across some studies of Neil Anderson Freedom in Christ workshops. So those are really specialized types of interventions, and you would not be probably using those types of interventions, or you would get into trouble if you use those types of interventions in a traditional secular setting. So I wanted to exclude those types of research that were not particularly valid to my research question. So moving on to the next slide, I found 14 studies. And this kind of gives you a sense of just the breadth of research on this particular topic. So in Saudi Arabia, there was a random control trial that looked at the effectiveness of spiritually modified cognitive behavioral therapy. In other words, CBT that was modified with Islamic content amongst Muslims wrestling with schizophrenia. In Malaysia, there was 3 studies that used Islamic modified CBT to address problems such as anxiety disorder, depression, and bereavement. In China, there was a study where CBT had been modified with precepts from Taoism. There was a case study in New Zealand of a Christian wrestling with obsessive-compulsive disorder. There was a study in the U.S. where CBT had been modified with tenets drawn from the Latter-day Saint tradition to address clients who are wrestling with perfectionism. And there was a number of studies done in the U.S. with Christians wrestling with depression. There was also all these other studies, CBT had been modified with tenets from a specific faith tradition. But in these last set of studies, there was sort of a generic spiritually modified CBT that was used to address stress. In Australia, there was also a generic spiritually modified CBT that was used to address depression and bipolar disorder. So moving on to our next study here. I mean, sorry, our next slide. So to go back to the two frameworks that we talked about before. So if you're going to use the APA Division 12 criteria, which would be one framework that would be widely used, spiritually modified CBT would be classified as a well-established intervention for devout Christians wrestling with depression. So the research suggests that spiritually modified CBT is at least as effective as traditional cognitive therapy and may actually be more effective. So the trend was in favor of spiritually modified CBT being more effective. Now this is a significant finding because Christians are the largest faith community in the U.S. and depression is a significant mental health problem, one of the most significant mental health problems in the U.S. and the prevalence rates for depression appear to be increasing. Now moving on to the next slide. Whoops. So again, using the APA Division 12 criteria, spiritually modified CBT borders on being classified as probably efficacious with Muslims coping with depression. Our next slide. So using the Division 12 criteria, spiritually modified CBT should be classified as experimental with all other types of disorders. Okay, so moving on to our next slide. Now you remember that the Division 12 is just one evidence-based framework. There's also the APA's Presidential Task Force on Evidence-Based Practice, and as you recall, they defined best available research broadly. So moving on to our next slide. So this is just kind of a little summary of the available research on spirituality and religion. So the most exhaustive research that I'm aware of is conducted by Koenig, McCulloch, and Larson, and they examined over 1,600 studies on spirituality and religion. So some people would say that there's not too much research on spirituality and religion, and that was true a few decades ago, but things have really changed over the last 3 decades. So they found over 1,600 empirical studies on spirituality and religion. Now these are primarily cross-sectional studies, so they don't have the sort of weight of random controlled trials and are kind of a hierarchy of research methods. But according to the APA Task Force, Presidential Task Force, these types of studies should be factored into any kind of decision regarding the use of various spiritual interventions. So moving on to our next slide. So spirituality and physical health outcomes. So various measures of spirituality and religion. This is just kind of a brief overview of what Koenig, McCulloch, and Larson now than their study. So various measures of spirituality and religion were associated with lower levels of hypertension, heart disease, cancer, mortality rates, immune system dysfunction, stroke, moving on to our next slide, fewer negative health behaviors such as smoking, drug and alcohol abuse, risky sexual behavior, sedentary lifestyle. Moving on to our next slide. Now, all this being stated, it's important to qualify this in the sense that some studies have associated some religious variables with increased weight and increased intention to diet. And if you think about that, it makes a little bit of sense, because if you're a good Baptist, what do you do on a Sunday afternoon after church? You go out and you have a church dinner, or you go out for food or something like that. So the relationships are not uniformly positive. It's also important to note that these are aggregate relationships. In other words, they're just general relationships. So it doesn't mean that everybody that's highly spiritual is going to have a lower level of, let's say, stroke or some of those other factors. Moving on to our next slide, spirituality and mental health outcomes. So this would be an area that would probably be of more interest to us as social workers. So again, various measures of spirituality and religion have been associated with higher levels of well-being, happiness, life satisfaction, higher levels of hope and optimism, greater purpose and meaning in life. Next slide. Greater self-esteem, greater adaption to bereavement, higher marital stability and satisfaction, higher social support. Our next slide. Faster recovery from depression and lower rates of depression, lower rates of suicide and fewer positive attitudes about suicide, less anxiety. Moving on to our next slide. Less psychosis and fewer psychotic tendencies. Now that's really interesting, because many people would argue that psychosis is biologically based, and certainly there is a biological component, but this suggests that spirituality and religion are also relevant, somehow impact levels of psychosis. So also spirituality and religion have been associated with lower rates of alcohol and drug use or abuse, less delinquency and less criminal activity, and lower levels of loneliness. So to summarize, on our next slide, so regardless of which evidence-based practice framework one uses or affirms, sufficient evidence exists to warrant the use of spiritually modified CBT with at least some clients. So even if you're using the more restrictive APA Division 12 framework, there's warrant for using spiritually modified CBT. Now if you're using the APA's Presidential Task Force understanding of evidence-based practice, which is becoming more widely used or more widely affirmed, then there's even greater warrant for using evidence-based practice, for using a spiritually modified CBT, sorry. Okay, any questions about that content?
I have a question.
Okay, good.
Okay, you say that even if you're using the APA Division 12 criteria, the research does warrant being able to use the spiritually modified CBT. But
yeah.
doesn't your slide, and I'm sorry, mine don't have numbers on it, so I'm just looking at the APA Division 12 criteria when you write that it would be classified as experimental with anxiety, OCD, schizophrenia, etc.
Yeah.
That really it was only depression that came out as being well established.
Right.
Didn't you say earlier that if it were experimental, that that wouldn't be really a strong support for using it?
Yes, that's a good point. Thank you for bringing it up. Yeah. So if you're going to affirm, if you're someone that follows the Division 12 criteria, then the only people that you should be using virtually modified CBT with are developed Christians wrestling with depression.
Wow.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. But when you, sorry to extend that then, but using the Presidential Task Force framework, using with a more broad criteria, you're saying that for most disorders that you could see it would warrant using the spiritually modified CBT?
Yeah, it's much more of a judgment call.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the nice thing about the Division 12 criteria is it's just kind of a cookbook format. And
yes.
So it's simpler in some ways. Whereas with the presidential task force, it's much more nuanced. You factor in things like the evidence, which is one factor, client preference, your level of clinical expertise. So you have to look, you have to hold in balance all those different factors. And so when you talk about evidence, there's a lot of cross-sectional research that's been conducted by folks such as Coney, McCulloch, and Larson that says that spirituality and religion is productive or helpful or related to these various positive mental health constructs that we're interested in promoting in our practices. So when you take a look at that broader picture of evidence moving beyond just randomized controlled trials, I think it opens up a lot more leeway. So you can make a stronger argument that spiritually modified CBT is appropriate for use with a given client.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. That was a very good question.
I'm sorry. Regarding the Division 12 criteria about there needing to be a treatment manual, could you speak to that and if there is and how to locate that?
Yeah, the treatment manuals are usually fairly accessible. If the research is funded by the federal government, I think, I don't quote me on this, but I think they're required by law to actually make their treatment manual available. So, but what the way to access treatment manuals would be to go to the study and then contact the individual. So individuals are saying they've used the treatment manual. I think in most cases, they're willing to make that treatment manual available. So does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Any other questions? Okay.
I kind of had one, but
yeah.
I don't want to ramble about it.
No,
I'm just wondering if some of the answers about whether something is useful or not, if there are folks that want to find out whether maybe they want to try to do some research studies on it and see what they find.
So yeah, so if I understand what you're saying, is if some question arises about the effectiveness, would it be appropriate to do some research to actually see if it is effective or not? Is that correct?
Right, and I would think if there was enough people that wanted to know, maybe they could spearhead that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. The factor that sort of mitigates against that or cuts against that is the whole issue of time. So people are so busy that, unfortunately, research tends to fall down the list. But I think that's a great idea.
Right, because I work with homeless pregnant women, and we had some questions regarding recovery for women that are recovering addicts, and so when I was taking a research class, because that was a burning issue to me, that's what I did my project on.
Okay.
And found out that there hadn't been a lot of research about it, but it certainly caused some people to examine their practices.
Yeah, some people would even make the case that practitioners should be moving towards sort of evaluating their own practices on a kind of a single case research methodology and just kind of seeing for themselves what tends to work more effectively and kind of getting a sense for what works and what doesn't work. I mean, people do that anyway on an informal basis, but just to use psychometrically validated measures to sort of provide a little bit more scientific rigor to kind of add on to or flesh out just the intuitive sense that we all have about what works and what doesn't work in our practices. So, good point. Okay, any other questions? Okay, well, let's move on then to the next component. So outcomes that potentially may be enhanced by using spiritually modified CBT. Now that's with spiritually motivated clients, so I just want to point that out and emphasize that. So we're talking about working with spiritually motivated clients. It doesn't really make much sense to be using spiritually modified CBT with secular clients because it's not going to resonate with them, or in other words, it's not going to be culturally competent. It's going to exhibit the opposite. It's going to exhibit like culturally insensitive practice to try to use spiritually modified CBT with someone that has no interest in spirituality. Okay, so as Rick mentioned in the introduction, on the next slide, there's four outcomes that may be improved with spiritually modified, with using spiritually modified CBT with spiritually motivated clients. And that includes faster recovery, enhanced treatment compliance, and may prevent relapse and reduce treatment disparities. And we'll talk about each one of those in brief. So the next slide, faster recovery. So clients are typically motivated to change by lack of satisfaction with their present circumstances. They're just kind of fed up. Things aren't working. They're experiencing some pain or existential angst with how things are going. And as a result, they decide to see a therapist. So that's kind of the motivation that drives many, if not most, clients to see therapists. Then we can think about that as kind of being one type of motivational engine. Now, incorporating spirituality into CBT can tap a different type of motivational engine. It can tap client's spiritual motivation. So, in effect, what we're doing, ideally, is tapping two different motivational engines. So just the more traditional motivational engine of dissatisfaction with present circumstances, and also a spiritual motivation. So by tapping two motivational engines, we may achieve faster recovery. And moving on to our next slide, enhanced treatment compliance. So treatment retention is awfully a problematic issue, particularly for minority clients, which tend to drop out of clients. So not just, let's say, African-American clients or Latino clients, but clients from working-class backgrounds, etc. Now, there are many reasons for this, but one reason is that the therapy is typically presented as a secular format or in a secular methodology. As a result, clients may not buy in to something that doesn't resonate with their worldview, doesn't sort of resonate with their cultural background. So integrating spirituality into therapy may increase client buy-in among those clients that prioritize spirituality because it resonates with who they are. It just makes sense. So that may lead to less attrition because clients buy in to the therapy, so they're more willing to complete the therapy. And also, that may provide added support for their continuing in the therapy by engaging family members and spiritual communities that also sort of support their spirituality. So moving on to the next slide, post-treatment relapse. So relapse is a common issue after successful treatment. So the secular motivation, typically, dissatisfaction with present circumstances is no longer operative, so clients are cured, things are going better, their life is better. And as a result, there's a tendency to relapse because clients sort of stop working the program or they stop implementing the intervention that caused them to achieve healing. So if CBT protocols are constructed in a way that resonates with clients' spiritual and religious beliefs, then spiritually motivated clients have an ongoing rationale to implement the protocols. So ideally, if the cognitive self statements can be framed as a form of spiritual practice, then clients that are interested in growing spirituality have a reason to continue to implement the self statements long after the treatment ends, and that can prevent relapse. Moving on to the next slide. Reduce treatment disparities. So underutilization of mental health services is a major problem. So again, this has been documented with lower class, people from the working classes, or what some people call the underclass amongst Latinos, African Americans, the elderly, and many other groups tend to underutilize mental health services. So by making the treatment more culturally relevant, so again, we're talking about spiritually motivated clients, by making the treatment more culturally relevant to spiritually motivated clients, some individuals that would otherwise not receive services may be willing to receive services. Now, some individuals avoid seeking assistance due to concerns about being stigmatized by their communities. So framing therapeutic interventions as a form of spiritual practice can help mitigate these concerns about stigmatization by normalizing the treatment both in the eyes of clients and in community members. So if you have some kind of mental health problem like depression, for instance, there may be some stigma associated with receiving treatment for depression. But if the treatment can be framed as a form of spiritual practice, of somebody working on their spirituality in conjunction, let's say, with their clergy member, then that it can appear very different both to clients and to the broader community, and it can reduce stigmatization. And that, therefore, people that would be inclined not to receive mental health services may be more open to receiving services. So to summarize, so it's possible that spiritually modified CBT may speed recovery, enhance treatment compliance, prevent relapse, and reduce treatment disparities. Now, it's important to emphasize the may here. So there has not been research that has documented these positive outcomes. In my own work, I'm interested in exploring some of these issues after I get tenure, hopefully. But currently, it's just suggestive. So these are kind of like arguments that seem to make sense to me and to many others. I think that they're rational arguments, but we haven't actually documented them yet. Okay, questions about that content?
Would it be fair to say, would it be fair to use the word discipleship when you're talking about a form of spiritual practice that continues past therapy, to frame it as normative to the discipleship journey? Would that be a fair reframe?
Yeah, I think that's good. Now, the issue that we all need to be careful about is the whole issue of competence and boundaries. So we just need to be careful that we don't fall into the role of the spiritual director, where we're trying to nurture someone's spirituality. So that would be the job of clergy, whereas our job is to utilize spiritual and religious strength to help clients address particular problems that they come to us for. So it's kind of a question of emphasis. So clergy members would deal with spirituality. We might deal with spirituality as mental health professionals. But our goal is to use spiritual or religious strengths to help people address problems and function okay in society. But yeah, in terms of a reframe, that makes sense. I just wanted to bring up the whole boundary issue as well. So does that answer your question?
It does. It seems cyclical, though, because utilizing spiritual strength for a therapeutic end would then go back to the strengthening of the discipleship. I'm trying to sort it out in my mind what the difference would look like in practice.
Yeah, it's a question of emphasis, because if you're a clergy member, you're dealing with spirituality and you're dealing with real life problems like marital issues or depression or problems with kids, whatever it is. So as a spiritual director, you would take the gist of life, the stuff of life, and you would use that to counsel people to develop their spirituality, to increase their relationship with God. So that would be, I think, the general emphasis of clergy members. Now, for us as mental health practitioners, our emphasis is different. So we deal with the gist of life, the marital problems, etc. So that's kind of our key focus. We're less concerned, or even almost like unconcerned in one sense, but we're less concerned with clients' relationship with God. So we're much more concerned with helping them deal with the problems that they come to us for, and then exploring resources in their environment, in their worldview, that can help them deal with those problems. In many cases, they have spiritual or religious strengths that can be tapped into or operationalized to help them deal with those problems, but not in all cases. So it's a different emphasis for us as mental health workers as opposed to clergy members.
Now, would that change, say, for example, the advanced studies in transformational therapy? Would that emphasis change somewhat?
I'm not sure with that particular modality.
Yeah, for example, AACC has some postgraduate studies available in transformational therapy, learning how
okay.
to be a transformational therapist.
Okay.
Talking about spiritual transformation.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, in that case, then, you would be, there wouldn't be the same kind of boundary or competency issue because you would be trained and certified in that particular area, if I understand you correctly. So if you were, let's say, certified to do spiritual transformation, then it would be appropriate, and then people were coming to you with the understanding that that was a large part of what you did. I think that would...
Jacqueline Griggs.
That would be legitimate.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Kathleen. Any other questions?
I would be interested to know how big of a subset of social workers out there are trained in both disciplines. I have been, and so that enables me to do some things that maybe some social workers wouldn't because of having the competency in both disciplines.
Right. Yes, I would agree with you. My sense is that most social workers don't have that dual training that you do. I'm unaware of any research but on the topic, but just based on my sort of sense of being lots of social workers. So you would be kind of in a unique situation.
Right, and that's why I'm trying to kind of gauge the need in my community, and particularly under the new Missouri faith-based initiative, to see how what I have to offer could be most useful there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think some people might still say, well, there could be some role issues that come into play, in the sense that what sort of role are you occupying? Are you occupying the role of clergy, or are you occupying the role of mental health professional? But that's kind of like a whole other can of worms.
Right, and maybe that's where some of the informed consent things go too, so that that they understand what I'm willing to offer, and I would find out what it is that they want.
That's a very, very good point. Thank you for bringing that up. That's good. Yeah, so the whole informed consent thing would be very helpful at that point.
Right. So when you mentioned the dual roles, you're speaking there about being trained as a clergy as well as being trained as the clinical social worker?
Yes.
Right.
Thanks. Be nice.
So the fact that they're combined in one individual, that can be a really good thing, and that can open up a lot of doors, and it can be really helpful for clients. But at the same time, some people would argue that couldn't be problematic in some situations, because if people are dealing with a spiritual issue, that they'd be better off receiving input from someone that specializes in that, opposed to, in other words, there's some situations when it may be helpful to keep the two areas distinct from one another.
Okay.
But I think in general, though, I mean, that's, some people would make that argument. I think in general, if you have both sets of competencies, that's to your advantage, and generally speaking, I think that's a really good thing, and it's really increases, it can potentially increase the effectiveness of your practice. Any other questions? Okay, well, if not, let's move on to our next section here, modifying traditional secular CBT statements to resonate with client spiritual belief systems. So in terms of background on our next slide, so again, to reiterate, traditional CBT focuses on identifying unhealthy self statements and replacing them with health-promoting self statements. So it's important, I think, to realize that Ellis is really the father of the modern sort of incarnation of cognitive behavioral therapy. If you read Beck's stuff, Beck is another person who's commonly looked at as being one of the founders in this area. But if you read Beck, Beck will say he was influenced by Ellis. So Ellis is really kind of the key figure here. So the next slide, constructing spiritually modified CBT self-statements. It's really, you can look at it in terms of a three-step process, and we'll just go over each step. So unpacking the European Enlightenment values from the underlying therapeutic concept in the statement, evaluating the basic concepts to ensure their congruence with the client's spiritual narrative, then repackaging the key concepts and values drawn from the client's spiritual belief system. So moving on to the next slide, separate the underlying therapeutic concept from the secular values in which the concept is packaged. Now, Ellis was a committed atheist. In many of his writings, he associates devout belief with pathology. In other words, if you're a devout Christian, for example, you're pathological, you're evidencing ill health. So now, when Ellis crafted his self-statements, they tend to reflect his worldview. Now, I should say, in fairness to Ellis, Ellis has come a long ways, and he's much more supportive of people of faith than he was earlier in his career. But he did start out being very antagonistic towards people of faith, and that's part of the larger therapeutic culture. So if you take a look at someone like Freud, who many people would say is the most influential individual in mental health practice, he felt that religious faith was a delusion. In other words, it was a form of pathology. Fromm and others, other influential therapists, have also argued that mental health practice, or other major thinkers and movers and shakers in mental health practice, have argued that religious belief is a form of psychopathology. And there's been a significant amount of research that's come out in the last 30 years, as I alluded to earlier, that have really helped sort of change things. And as a result of this research, Ellis has really modified his views. But nevertheless, he is still a committed secular individual who affirms basic Enlightenment values. So what does that mean? The Enlightenment was sort of about, to grossly simplify, the Enlightenment can be understood as a movement that kind of decentered God and placed human beings, in particular human rationality, as the center. So previous to the Enlightenment in a Western tradition, God was sort of the focal point, the oriented point. The Enlightenment dethroned God and enthroned a secular worldview, in particular human beings and human reason, as the center of the universe. And all knowledge worth knowing could be understood through human rationality. That's what some people would argue is the basis of modernism, which is fading out in favor of postmodernism. So to come back to our point here, it's important to look beyond the words, beyond the self-statement, to try to grasp the fundamental ideas that the vocabulary is designed to convey. So you want to ask yourself, like, what is the central healing concept here that this self-statement is designed to address? And identify that. So moving on to the next slide. Ensure the underlying therapeutic concept is congruent with the client's spiritual belief system. So indicators of mental health or pathology are not universal, and this is now recognized by the latest edition of the DSM, which notes that indicators of mental health can vary from culture to culture. So for example, in a secular culture, hearing a voice external to oneself is known to be a marker of schizophrenia, but the DSM recognizes that in some cultures, hearing a voice external to oneself is normative. So, for instance, if you're from the Pentecostal tradition, it's not uncommon for people to hear a voice external to oneself. People report that they're hearing God tell them what to do. So it's important to ensure that the underlying therapeutic concept is consistent with the client's worldview. So if it's not consistent, then the concept would be thrown out. Okay, moving on to our next slide. Repackage the therapeutic concept in terminology drawn from the client's spiritual narrative. So once you've identified the concept, you want to work with the client to express the concept in a new self-statement, in a new vocabulary that makes sense within the context of the client's spiritual narrative. Now, ideally, it should be, the self-statement should be expressed as a form of spiritual practice. And again, this is where clergy are often helpful in this sort of construction process. Perhaps some homework could be assigned in which the client would go and work with their clergy and come up with some sort of self-statement that would resonate within the context of his spiritual belief system. So to summarize, the underlying therapeutic concept is identified, discussed with the client to ensure congruence with the client's spiritual belief system, and then rearticulated in language drawn from the client's spiritual worldview. Now in practice, this tends to be a little bit more circular than linear, but I think it's helpful, at least from a conceptual point of view, to kind of to lay it out this way as three steps. Now, in terms of developing these spiritual self-statements, I think it helps to have some sort of familiarity with the norms in various spiritual traditions. So, for instance, if you're working in an area where there's a lot of Southern Baptists, then it will be helpful to kind of know how Southern Baptists look at the world, what their worldview is consisted of, what are their theological tenets. And again, just the importance of working with clergy. So any questions about that particular content? Okay, if there's no questions, so we'll just move into our next segment then. So now we'll take that theoretical model and we'll actually construct some spiritually modified CBT self-statements. So we'll start off with two examples from the Islamic tradition, and then we'll do some examples from Christianity. So the next slide. So here we have a problem, and the problem is undisciplined lifestyle, instant gratification. So this is a client that has a really sort of undisciplined lifestyle. They just feel trapped in the sense that they just got to have their needs met instantly. So Ellis has come up with this self-statement that addresses this particular problem. So Ellis says that the way to address undisciplined lifestyle is to have the client work with this self-statement that goes, since I often make myself undisciplined and self-defeating by demanding that I absolutely must have instant gratifications, I can give up my short-range needs, look for the pleasure of today and tomorrow, and seek life satisfaction in a disciplined way. So if I had to ask you, so what would you say the underlying therapeutic concept is of this self-statement? Anyone want to take a stab at this? So I'll read a self-statement again. Since I often make myself undisciplined and self-defeating by demanding that I absolutely must have immediate gratifications, I can give up my short-range, quote-unquote, needs, look for the pleasure of today and tomorrow, and seek life satisfactions in a disciplined way. So Ellis argues that this self-statement is ideally suited to address the problem of an individual who has an undisciplined lifestyle or that they're seeking instant gratification. Well, I'll just do one here just to give you a sense of how it goes. So there's up on the top of the next slide, you might argue that self-control is sort of at the heart of what Ellis is talking about here. And I've summarized the underlying therapeutic concept in yellow. So this is just my way of summarizing the underlying therapeutic concept, but there are lots of other ways. So the nice thing about these self-statements is there's a number of different ways to put them together.
David, just to interrupt for a second, when you were looking for a reply, I didn't hit the correct unmuting function, so people might have been answering, but no one would have been heard, so I apologize for...
Oh, okay. Okay, thanks for that input, Rick. So one way to understand this underlying therapy, the concept is I've written there in yellow, healthy functioning can be achieved by adapting the belief that it is possible to change and live in a measured and controlled manner. So that's one way to kind of summarize. Now, is this concept congruent with Islam? So on the next slide, I think that most people would say that it is. Most Muslims would say that it is. And on the next slide, I've taken that therapeutic concept and I've re-expressed it in Islamic phraseology. So God will gave us free will, including the ability to control ourselves. In addition, God has also given us many opportunities to practice self-control through fasting during Ramadan and weekly sunnah fasting on Mondays and Thursdays. These are ways, with the help of Allah, we can enhance our self-discipline and change for the better. Moving on to the next slide. So I've put my version of this Islamically modified CBT self-statement up on the top of the slide. Now, one of the things that you can see with this is it incorporates reference to God. So it's not just a completely secular self-statement. It also incorporates activities that may help Muslims practice self-restraint, such as fasting during Ramadan or in traditional fasting on Monday and Thursday. So this hopefully makes the statement more relevant to a Muslim as opposed to Alice's statement, which is completely secular and completely human-centric as opposed to this particular version. So this, by incorporating sort of these hooks into traditional culture, this may remind Muslims of practices within their own tradition that can help them to develop self-control. So moving on to our next particular slide. So the problem in this case is being dependent upon or needing a stronger other or some stronger person. So Ellis, in his self-statement, said that the way to address this problem is through the following self-statement. I prefer to have some caring and reliable people to depend upon, but I do not need to be dependent and do not have to find someone stronger than me to rely upon. So what would you say is the underlying therapeutic concept in this particular self-statement? Anyone want to take a guess? And again, there's no real wrong answer. So just the idea is like, what is the sort of the kernel, the therapy?
I think one of the things you might get out of that is that someone would be more self-sufficient, but they'd like to know that they're also, if they need it, there's someone else to rely on some types of situations, but they'd like to practice self-sufficiency the most.
Okay, that's good. Anyone else? So again, there's any number of ways to express the sort of underlying therapeutic concept.
That there's something better about being independent.
Okay. Anyone else want to take a shot at it? Okay, well, thank you, you two brave souls. So, so we'll move on to the next slide. And so, I've just put my understanding of this therapeutic concept, which is basically the same thing that you folks said. So it's there in yellow. Healthy individuals are, in some sense, self-sufficient. They do not need to rely upon others for direction. Now, is this concept congruent with Islam? Well, many people would say no. So if we move on to the next slide. So understandings of humans as autonomous, self-directed beings tends to conflict with the Islamic worldview in which people are understood to need someone stronger than themselves on whom they can rely, and most notably God. So this concept of being independent conflicts with the Islamic view that dependence is really important. First, dependence upon God, and second, dependence upon the broader Islamic community. So within the Islamic worldview, dependence is appropriate and normal for healthy human functioning. So in many cases, we might want to discard this particular therapeutic concept. because it's incongruent, so it's kind of our second step, is incongruent with Islamic belief system. So moving on to our next slide. So these are going to be our Christian examples. So I use those two Islamic examples to hopefully give you some sort of sense of how the process works. And now I'll move on to Christian examples. So in this particular situation, we have someone that just feels trapped by their past, that they can't escape the past. It's just, they're just stuck there and they're doomed to reproduce unproductive behaviors and patterns. So Ellis would say that this self-statement is a way to address the problem of being trapped in someone's past. No matter how bad or handicapping my past was, I can change my earlier thoughts and feelings and behaviors today. I do not have to keep repeating and reenacting my past. So what would you say would be the underlying therapeutic concept?
There's always the possibility for change.
Okay, so the possibility of change exists. Anyone else want to take a stab at it?
Certainly for a Christian, with God, nothing is impossible. And
okay.
So tapping into your faith to give you the strength to do something different.
Okay, good. Anybody else? Well, we had two brave souls again. So we'll move on to the next slide then. And then so one way again, there's many ways to express the underlying therapeutic concept. So the ways that I've chosen are listed there in yellow. The possibility of change regardless of one's past. So that's one of the therapeutic kernels that this above self statement is trying to express. And then the other is the concept of personal agency, that people can make changes, that they're not trapped in the past. So do you think that these therapeutic concepts are congruent with Christianity?
Yes.
Okay, so yes, anyone want to disagree? So again, it's like there's no real right or wrong answers here.
I think they are, but that we're also missing forgiveness and the power of forgiveness.
Okay. So that's good.
Yeah.
So maybe there's some other therapeutic concepts that could be woven into this.
Redemption.
So let's just say for the sake of argument that concepts are congruent with Christianity. We'll move on to the next slide. So this is how I've chosen to express this underlying therapeutic concept. So it's this comes from, I believe this is a direct quote from the New Testament using Eugene Peterson's The Message, which is a modern paraphrase of the New Testament. So it says, I am united with the Messiah, and consequently, I have been given a fresh start by God. My old life has passed away. My new life has begun. So in this case, a theological or spiritual teaching doubles the therapeutic self-statement. So you can see how this might be useful with, let's say, an individual. Let's say their church has some kind of a scripture memorization program, or they're in a kind of a discipleship forum where they're being encouraged to memorize scripture, or maybe they have some interest in meditating on scripture. So by framing this statement as a theological tenet, it really sort of taps into those two motivational engines that we're talking about. So this statement, I think, captures that it is possible to change with God's help, and that we're able to change personal agency, again, with God's help. Okay, so moving on to our next self-statement. So we have the problem of being overwhelmed by uncomfortable emotions, such as anxiety or depression. So Ellis has his self-statement here, which is designed to address this problem of being overwhelmed by uncomfortable emotions. So Ellis would say that my disturbed feelings, such as anxiety or depression, are quite uncomfortable, but they are not awful and do not make me a stupid person for indulging them. If I see them as hassles rather than horrors, I can live with them more effectively and give myself a better chance to minimize them. So what would you say would be the underlying therapeutic precept here?
Reframing.
So what's our therapeutic kernel that Alice thinks addresses this problem of being overwhelmed by uncomfortable emotions?
I think he's saying that they're a normal and inevitable part of life.
Okay. That's good. Thank you. Anyone else want to take a shot?
It sounds to me, David, like we have one brave soul who's very young and just beginning to
learn. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't able, even though I've got two small children myself, I wasn't able to interpret what that person was saying, Rick.
I'm sure it was insightful.
I have no doubt.
I was gonna say that it was a reframe, the statement by Ellis, looking at the uncomfortable emotion in a different light.
Okay. Okay.
I think the therapeutic precept might be self-esteem.
Okay.
How we see ourselves.
Okay. Good. Anybody else want to chip in with? Okay, let me move on to the next slide then. So to kind of follow up on what some of you folks said, so my understanding would be that emotionally difficult feelings are not intolerable, but can handle them, but rather unpleasant entities that can be managed. So is this a therapeutic concept that's congruent with Christianity? I would say yes, would be my guess. So moving on to the next slide, so accepting emotional disturbance, which is somewhat similar to what some of you folks have said. So I've phrased this in the following way. God promises never to let me experience more than I can bear. Although feelings such as anxiety and depression are uncomfortable, I can manage them by turning to God. I am not bad, stupid, or a sinner for having such feelings, but rather I have unique dignity, worth, and strength because I am a child of God, created in His image. So let's move to the next slide. So on the next slide, we've written that up at the top of the slide. So there's some things that I'd just like to comment on here. So again, as with the case with the Muslim self-statements, so we supplanted human agency with some other factors. So for instance, more specifically, God's control of the universe. So why is it true that I should accept emotional disturbance just because I tell myself that? Well, that may be one good factor, and that may work for secular people. If you're secular, that's really all you have. You can tell yourself that I should accept emotional disturbance, but that's just you telling yourself that. So here we've added another component. We've added the component that God's in control of the universe. He's promised us victory, so He's promised never to let us experience more than the individual can bear. And also, God promises to help His children, within the Christian tradition again, overcome problems. So by incorporating these various promises and these various theological tenets within Christianity into the self-statement, we may increase its cultural relevance, so it makes more sense, clients are more apt to implement the self-statement, etc. Now moving on to the next slide. So in addition to the client's verbal declaration of worth, arguments against feelings of unworthiness are anchored in the client's status as a person created in the image of God. So as I said before, this increases the statement's cultural relevance. We're providing an additional argument. So we have the argument that the person is saying that they should accept emotional disturbance, which is the case with a secular statement. They just say that I should accept emotional statement. They just tell themselves that truth. But you're adding an additional argument that this is a divine precept that God is going to, that you should accept emotional disturbance, but in addition, you're never going to experience more than you can bear. So these arguments have the force of revealed truth for developed believers. And so again, that counts for something for developed believers as well, because this is not just some sort of statement that a therapist and the individual has crafted themselves in a therapeutic session, but these self-statements, these spiritually modified self-statements, have carried the force of revealed truth. So as a result, they may be more inclined to implement them, and they may be more inclined to actually believe that they are true. So moving on to the next self-statement. Our next problem is depression caused by self-berating cognitions. So this is a common problem. People berate themselves, and that leads to depression. So Ellis has crafted a secular self-statement to deal with this problem, and it says, I can always choose to give myself unconditional self-acceptance and see myself as a quote-unquote good person just because I am alive and human, whether or not I act well, and whether or not I am lovable. Better yet, I can choose to rate and evaluate only my thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, but not give myself, that is my essence or my total being, a global rating. When I fulfill my personal and social goals and purposes, that is good. But I am never a good or bad person. So what would be the underlying therapeutic concept here?
Okay, the lines are open. And David, just a quick time check. We've got about 7 minutes before 3.
Okay, yeah, we're almost, I think this is our last example. So we're almost done.
Well, the intrinsic worth of the human.
Okay, that's good. The intrinsic worth of the human being.
Separating the worth of the person from the behavior of the person.
Okay, that's good.
Positive self-acceptance.
Sorry, what was that?
Positive self-acceptance.
Self-acceptance, okay, good. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, good. Well, those are all good. Now, again, just while we have this self-statement up, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that, again, how this represents, this self-statement reflects Ellis's worldview. So it's completely human-centric. There's no mention of God. It's just whatever, all those sort of therapeutic kernels that you mentioned, that they're all, there's sort of like no real rationale for why they should be true. So Ellis just says that the person should just tell themselves that they're a good person or whatever. But there's no real sort of basis for that statement. There's no foundation to suggest that it's true that you're a good person. But Ellis argues that just by telling yourself that you're a good person, then that has some sort of like therapeutic element to it. So these secular self-statements have been proven, as I said in the past, to be effective. So by incorporating some spiritual tenets that sort of add to these self-statements, it seems to me that you can make the case that you're going to increase effectiveness. So moving on to the next slide. So my sense of the underlying therapeutic concept is very similar to some of the concepts that you've mentioned. So at some sort of fundamental level, people are worthy of unconditional acceptance. I would say that this concept is very congruent with Christianity. Then on the next slide, so I've crafted this self-statement that sort of reflects this notion of unconditional self-acceptance. So regardless of my actions or feelings, I always have dignity, worth, and value as a person created in your image. While it is appropriate to evaluate my actions do not impact my value as one of your children. Even when I sin, you still accept and love me. As your child, I always have intrinsic worth. Thank you, Father God. So again, this is one possible self-statement. So this is written in the form of a prayer to show some diversity. So if you move on to the next slide. So what this self-statement does is it just sort of anchors the person's self-acceptance in the client's relationship with God. So it's just not a verbal pronouncement. There's a rationale for why acceptance should exist. So this may have more logical force with devout clients because it carries the weight of revealed theological truth. And the fact that it's constructed in the form of prayer may have some benefits. So, for instance, you could ask a client to incorporate this into regular prayer routine, or you could encourage them, maybe if they are a client that engages in meditation on a regular basis, they could perhaps meditate on this. So, again, I think it's very plausible that we can expect to see better outcomes because we're tapping two different motivational engines. So we're tapping the traditional secular motivation, so we're not really detracting from anything that Ellis has done. We're really sort of adding to it by rephrasing, reconstructing these self statements into spiritually modified statements. Okay, so moving on to our last couple of slides here, what we've covered in our previous 2 hours. So we've seen that many, and probably most, social work practitioners use spiritual interventions in their practice of social work, at least sometimes. We talked about two different evidence-based frameworks for assessing effectiveness of spiritual interventions and other types of interventions. So the older Division 12 standards and the more recent Presidential Task Force standards, which I would say are sort of becoming the norm within social work. Then we looked at research. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice here. I ran out of water, unfortunately. I don't have time to get another one. So we've looked at research on spiritually modified CBT from an evidence-based perspective. And we've seen that if you use the Division 12 standards, that it's legitimate to use spiritually modified CBT to address depression amongst devout Christians. And if you adhere to the APA's Presidential Task Force on evidence-based practice, their sort of framework, then I think it opens up the use of spiritually modified CBT with a much wider array of clients dealing with a much wider array of problems. And I think it's legitimate to expect, at least in some cases, enhanced outcomes, and those enhanced outcomes maybe look like things such as faster recovery, or enhanced treatment compliance, or lower levels of relapse, and also reduced treatment disparities. So in some kind of combination, I don't know if we can expect that every client is going to experience all four of those outcomes. Maybe one client experiences one positive outcome, another client experiences two. But those are four positive outcomes, I think, that we can realistically expect. Moving on to the next slide. So we talked about the three steps of constructing spiritually modified CBT self-statements. The first step is to sort of separate the underlying therapeutic concept from the secular values in which the concept is packaged, and then work with the client. Actually, I shouldn't say that. This whole process you would involve the client in, so it's not just one step. So it's kind of a circular thing in which you would work with the client to address each one of these particular dimensions. And the second component is ensure the underlying therapeutic concept is congruent with the client's spiritual value system. So you can see how that you would want to talk to the client about the degree of congruence. And then third, to repackage the therapeutic concept in terminology that really resonates with the client's spiritual belief system. And then we did a few practice instructions. So that's I think our time for today. So I just want to thank everybody that came, and I hope that you found this process, this 2 hours well spent and useful in your practice of social work. So thank you very much for attending. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, David, for just a wonderfully refreshing and cutting-edge presentation. Lots to think about and lots to look for ways to integrate in our practice.
You're very welcome.
Thanks also to everyone who joined us for the session today. We'd appreciate receiving your evaluation of our audio conference and hearing your suggestions for future audio conferences. So you should receive from me in just a few minutes an email that will invite you to take an online survey of today's session. Secondly, for those of you interested in obtaining documentation for continuing ed contact hours, please download the 10 post-training questions. We're posted on our website. If you have any difficulty accessing those, please send me an email, and I'll be glad to send you another link so that you can get those and send those in. And then lastly, I invite you to consider signing up for our next audio conference workshop scheduled for September 28th. The topic is going to be using the Internet and related technologies to support distance education and training, and will be led by Peggy Pittman-Monk with Murray State University. That being said, thank you so much for joining us today, David, for leading us.
You're
and
very
I wish
welcome.
You all a terrific rest of your afternoon.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rick?
Yeah,
Rick.
Did he
send help? Will you send an email about a reference for the informed consent?
Yes, actually, I sent David an email right at the end of our session and asked him to send that reference to me. So maybe tomorrow, the next day, just send me an email and say, Rick, send it along, and I'll pass it right to you.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, and who was this?
This is Diane Simile.
Okay, Diane, sure. Just send me that queuing email. David's usually very quick in response. My guess is he'll probably have it to me before the day's out. And when I get your email, I'll turn it right around.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Registered for it online, see, and then they gave me the link and to receive your, here's my, what's this attachment? What are you? That might be my, oh yeah, that's how I paid for it and all that stuff.
Pay to,
oh, I see, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.